This recording of Ram Dass was made on November 19, 1978, at a symposium of the Association of Humanistic Psychology entitled The Seasons of Our Lives, held at Irvine, California.
Well, this is the second of the Seasons of Our Lives conferences that I've attended. And I'm again impressed with Bill's courage in bringing together such a potpourri of presenters. While my vehicle is words, I don't really believe anything I say, because the nature of my work concerns the spaces between the words rather than the words themselves. For I'm dealing with an area, a realm of human existence, that is basically not conceptual, and I'm faced with the predicament of trying to convey a non-conceptual realm through concept. So I must ask you at the outset to take my words with a grain of salt. If you don't like them, don't worry about them. They will pass quickly. In order to understand the stages of life, and ultimately the process of dying, one has to have a context in which to understand these things. And the context usually is defined as, what is the meaning of it? What am I doing here on earth? Because having an understanding of one's function or purpose makes one understand whether some process that's going on in transformation is functional or dysfunctional, whether or not it's useful or not. I mean, I think none of us are so naive at this point, certainly not in this gathering of professionals and people related in related fields. None of us are so naive as to think that only that which gives pleasure is useful. I think most of you now have found through your own experiences that there is incredible growth through suffering. That doesn't mean that we would go around programming suffering into people's lives. We don't give suffering 101, which is electrodes under. And yet, when we look back at our own lives, we see that some of the most profound changes occurred at the times of the most intense suffering. And the nature of the suffering is that we are confronting a situation which is dissonant or disparate from the model we have of how reality ought to be. And that's really what the cause of suffering is. The cause of suffering is this place in your mind that's defining how you think it ought to be. So if you think things should be a certain way and they're not, then there's a discomfort and you suffer. And a lot of what our suffering has been is not due to the actual characteristics of the situation, but to the way in which we perceive the situation. And that perception is based on our contextual understanding of who we are and what we're doing here. So that I must delve a little bit more into the philosophical underpinnings of your and my existence for us to have an appreciation of what the seasons of our lives, particular reference to dying, how to perceive them, how to understand them in a useful way. I'll paint a scenario that just give you a little example of what I went through in some of my processing. I'm in Banaras, the city of dying in India. In the Hindu religion, the highest way in which you can die is to die in Banaras. And when you die in Banaras, your body gets burned at the burning ghat, and the bones and ashes get thrown into the Ganges River. And through that simple act, you are spiritually freed, and we'll talk a minute about what that might be about. The result of that belief system is that Benares is full of people dying. And most of these people have no money whatsoever. They are beggars at the most extreme states of survival. Many of them are lepers. They have a loincloth, man or woman, just a loincloth, and maybe a begging bowl. Many of them have advanced states of cancer. Many of them are just skin and bones. They are dragging themselves through the streets. And often on their loincloth, there is a little sack which contains the money necessary for the wood for their funeral pyre. Now, if you think of yourself as a human being and think of them as a human being and empathize for a moment with their predicament, here we are in Orange County having just had a nice lunch and being in comfortable soft chairs, it's hard to imagine even identifying and realizing these are fellow human beings. But they are. They're just like us. They've just got a different place in their minds and they're in a different life moment. When I first came to Benares, when I went out in the streets, I was in a very open space, and when I looked at these people, I experienced such horror. I couldn't really handle it at all. And I went back to my hotel room, and I am somewhat embarrassed to admit, I literally climbed under the bed. I hid under the bed, just in horror of the situation. Because I walked through the streets with my American Express traveler's checks in my pocket, with my security, with my ticket back to affluent America, and I was facing these other human beings in the extreme state of need and poverty. And my pity was more than I could handle. Subsequent to that, I met my spiritual teacher, and my whole life took a different turn, and I ended up living in a temple, studying Hindu philosophy, doing deep meditation, hatha yoga, so on. And I began to understand a different context about what life and death was about. And now, six or eight months later, I found myself in Benares again. And I walked through the streets, and this time, it was an entirely different experience for me. For when I looked into the eyes of these people, I saw in them not what I expected to see in the past, not self-pity, not frustration, not humiliation, not anger, not pleading. They had a look in their eyes of fulfillment. And then I noticed something else in their eyes that I could hardly believe. They were looking at me with pity. They were pitying me. Healthy, fat, solid American me. These people in the last stages of life were pitying me. And I understood that from their belief system, they were pitying me because I was merely this wanderer wandering through life, not knowing where I was going or where I was coming from. They knew their place. They were secure in their place. They were fulfilled in what they were about to do. And they knew that I was wandering in despair and I would never find. I mean, probably not find. And they just felt sorry that I was so lost. And I had trained enough so that I could see it from their point of view, and I ended up feeling self-pity. Now, to me, that's an example of how a belief system can be so strong that it can take what could be called a sad tune and make it into a happy tune. It can change the entire meaning of a situation. In the villages in India where I live quite a bit of the time, there are many beings who make 2, 3, 4 rupees a day. That's 40, 60 cents a day. And they have one meal a day, and they live maybe under a railroad bridge, crowded together. Not optimum living conditions. But sometimes when I look at their faces, I experience a being, a quality of their being, that seems more in tune or in harmony with the universe than I find in the face of somebody who is affluent, successful, everything in the West. And I understand, once I get over my arrogance of super race arrogance, that we have a great deal to learn about the dignity of the processes of life and death, and the way of understanding them in a way to release us rather than to torment us. I have to digress briefly to just share with you my own sequence of perceptual shift a little bit, so that you can appreciate the kinds of things I want to talk to you about. For I was trained as a social scientist and was a professor. I was actually part of a junta at Harvard to protest against the soft and mushy conditions of the clinical social psychology department, social relations department. I was one of those guys in favor of harder statistics, the kind of guys you love, right? I just felt that anybody that didn't know how to do a factor analysis and a chi-square just hadn't yet awakened. And though I played that game as hard as I knew how, for all the points I knew how to collect, there was in me, despite my psychoanalysis, there was a very gnawing uneasiness that I was missing something, a malaise. And when we experience a malaise in our culture, we tend to treat that malaise as if it is our fault. And we treat it as if it's our neurosis, and it's our lack of adaptability to the existing culture, which must be right because there's so many of them. And I kept trying, like fitting a square peg into a round hole, I kept trying to readapt my being to fit into the gratification patterns that the culture was offering me. And it just wasn't working. And I started to drink more, and I started to get more extreme in my ways of seeking pleasure in order to gain the kind of fulfillment to give me a feeling of well-being. Well, then I got for some years into experimentation with psychotropic chemicals, chemicals that alter consciousness, and that changed my head around a great deal. I saw through those experiments that perhaps my malaise, my discomfort, was not just my pathology, but it was a deeper something in me attempting to awaken. And that maybe instead of treating it as some sickness that ought to be treated as a problem, I should see it as something graceful, to be honored. And maybe it would be useful to allow my life to adapt, to tune to those feelings of wrongness or rightness within myself. And I did that, and I just let my life go in the course it would naturally take, responding to an inner intuitive sense of right. Okay, that's all right. And it took me through, away from academia, it took me through psychedelic chemicals, it took me to India, it took me into yoga, and it brought me back to America, and it took me into a different kind of a perceptual view of the universe. And I found, much to my surprise, that through whatever had happened to me, had very profoundly, in the real sense of alteration, had profoundly altered my feelings about death, and as a result, my feelings about life. It had very profoundly altered the definition of who I think I am. Now, I could try to very gently take you into the space translating, but instead of doing that, I'm going to do a much more shock treatment process. I'm just going to tell you how I see the world. And many of you will say, that is absolute rot. And that's perfectly okay. It's okay in advance. You have total license to reject it. But anything less than that would be dishonest on my part. So I'm going to go for broke. We'll let the chips fall where they will. Okay. I mean, I've convinced you I'm a nice person. I speak softly. I seem friendly. So now maybe we're ready for the as the blow fall. You knew I couldn't sit cross-legged up here and not. And I'll even be more outrageous by telling you that what I'm presenting to you is not a belief system. It's the way things are. See, already your shackles are up. But what can I do? Anything less would be dishonest. I just got to play. You've got to know people like me exist. To the extent that I am anything at all, and that we can open for question in a little while, seriously, we could consider me as a separate entity, a set of predisposing characteristics. You could call it would be like a DNA code, except we'll make it psychic instead of physical. I am a set of characteristics, a program that is manifesting by taking a human birth at this time. I have taken a birth into a body, and that body has with it a personality. I've taken a birth into a personality, and that personality is in a body. And I am going through a set of experiences which is called living life. And these experiences have a certain function. These experiences, if used consciously and intentionally by me, are vehicles through which I can awaken to who I am in truth. Let me take you through an example I often use, just another little metaphorical image and an analogy. Imagine, for example, that you have next to your eyes a little control switch, and you look at another human being on channel one. And what you see when you look at the other human being is a physical body. Man, woman, old, young, fat, thin, pretty, handsome, ugly, interesting. If you're a scientist, you might call them mesomorphs, ectomorphs, and endomorphs. Okay? It's a matrix of individual differences on physical plane. It's the plane of standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. It's that reality. Now let's just say you're looking at another person and you flick your television receiver one channel. Now you look at another person and what you see is their psychology. Oh, you're a manic depressive. Oh, you're a happy person. I wish I was happy like you. People in psychotherapy live on this channel usually. They see everybody in terms of personalities that just happen to be traveling in bodies. Okay. They're totally preoccupied with their own depressions, elations, fears, anxieties, loneliness, hopes, etc. And that's reality. That's the real you. And the physical body is merely the carrier of that. Well, let's flip it again. Flip it again and you look at another person, and if you are so trained to be able to see on this channel, you would say, oh, I know who you are. You're a Libra. I can tell because of the... You're a Sagittarius. On this channel, on channel 3, there's only 12 beings in the universe and various permutations of them. Okay. You are now seeing what could be known as the astral identity of an individual. You're seeing another plane of reality. You're seeing another way of looking at individual differences. These are three ways of looking at individual differences, three matrices, if you will. But now you flip the dial once more. It starts to get interesting. Now if you flip the dial and look into another person's eyes, you flip the dial inside your own being and look into another person's eyes, what you see is another being looking back at you. Inside an astral configuration, a personality, and a body. You in there? I'm in here. How did you get into that one? And you see what the Christians call soul. You see another soul. You see another being just like you. No different, just like you, just another being. And that you see that all the individual differences are all of the stuff in which this being is encased. Now, you could almost be comfortable with that one, but we unfortunately must flick the dial a few more times. I mean, I must take you the whole journey. You flick the next dial, and what you see when you look into someone else's eyes is you see yourself looking at yourself, looking at yourself. Because on that plane, there is only one of it. It is one awareness that is in a multiplicity of forms. And finally, if you allow me to flick the dial just once more, if you haven't given up completely yet, you flip the dial once more, and you disappear, and I disappear, and the dial disappears, and we're dealing with what the Buddhists call void, or in the New Testament, before the word, that is, before the vibratory uniqueness, or why God is not able to be spelled in the Hebrew religion. It's unspeakable, unknowable, unseeable, unconceivable, inconceivable. Okay, now of all of these channels on the television set, who are you? Which one do you want to settle for? You want to be middle-aged? How about that one? I mean, I'm middle-aged. I guess I'm middle-aged. I have a 47-year-old body. It's like I have also a 1974 Dodge van. But you say to me, who are you? And I don't say I'm a Dodge van. Why do I choose to identify with this? Well, if I don't pick body, should I pick personality? I'm somebody on the path. That's a good one to be. I'm a curious person. I'm curious about the future. That's a good one. I'm a responsible person. Well, I'm kind of wild. I'm lazy. I'm working on myself. These are all different psychological takes of who one is. Each plane, each turn of the dial has a different statement of your identity, and each one is getting into a more and more profound place. Now when we come back to who am I, which channel are you talking about? If we start from the top and go on down into the grosser and grosser planes, I am the void who manifests as the one, who becomes the many, who has a unique set of factors to work out through a unique astral, psychological, and physical body. That's what I'm doing on Earth. I have taken a body to do certain work. And when I finish that work, I will drop that body. We are dealing here with the issues of karma and reincarnation. Now, in the West, after the councils of Trent, Constantinople, and Nicaea, anywhere from about 200 to 500 AD, these ideas were roughly thrown out of Christianity because they didn't make the church a workable situation. Because when you had reincarnation and karma, every human being became their own priest. Because it was between you and God. And for the church to keep its own control, it needed to and see its function as keeping people morally living properly. It had to get rid of those concepts. Have I taken birth before? I have no experiential knowledge of that. But from where I'm sitting, undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. Will I take birth again? Undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. I have to tax your brain with one more difficult concept. As long as we were dealing with your body, with your personality, with your astral identity, or with your soul, we were dealing in time. Time passes, things change. The minute we got up into the higher plane than that, in the one, there is no time anymore. Time is relative. Now we're dealing with the place where when you know yourself as that, you just are. You are going nowhere and you are coming from nowhere. The Zen master says, your going and coming is nowhere but where you are. Now, if you can start to sense, I mean, you don't have to believe what I'm saying, just because it's the way the universe looks to me. But if you could empathize just enough to appreciate how it would be to be looking at the world from this point of view, here's a story that will explain that. I'll give you an example of it. Chinese were coming into Tibet, and they were very harsh on the Tibetan monks, who they saw as part of the decadence of Tibet. And they were very cruel to the monks, and they were disemboweling them and shaming them and killing them. And one particularly vicious commander of the army came into a village, and he said, bring all the monks before me. And they said, they've all fled to the hills except one monk in one monastery. And the general was pleased that they'd all fled, because he knew that then his power was known. And he couldn't understand why this one monk hadn't fled. And so he went to see the monk, and the monk was standing in the middle of the courtyard of the monastery. And the army commander walked up to him and he said, "Why didn't you flee? Don't you know who I am? I could take my sword and I could cut through you without blinking an eye." And the monk looked him in the eye and said, "Don't you know who I am? I am somebody who could be cut through by your sword without blinking an eye." And at that point, the commander bowed and left. Could you imagine what space that monk is in? Could you imagine what it's like to see your life as so functional to your awakening, and your death equally so, that the whole business becomes merely a process of growth and awakening and opening and deepening and clearing and shifting channels, and there is no problem about transition. There's no holding on out of fear. It's just opening. Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint, was dying of cancer, and he had great miraculous powers, and his devotees said to him, "Bhagwan, Ramana Maharshi, heal yourself." And he says, "No, this body's used up." And they said, "Don't leave us, don't leave us." And they started to cry. And he said to them, "Don't be silly. Where could I go?" That's like me saying, "I'm selling my Dodge van," and you saying, "Don't leave, don't leave." I'm not leaving, I'm just selling my Dodge van. Could you imagine conceiving of death from that point of view? I have a project going, working with terminally ill people, and it's not... I take exception to Dr. Comfort's, some of his criticisms this morning of hospice and of Elizabeth Ross and so on. But it isn't their work. Their work, which I think is extremely admirable, which is an attempt to make dying more psychologically humane, to take it out of the clutches of the medical profession, which treats each death as a failure, and which puts you in a hospital which is a temple to life, in which the only way to deal with death is denial. And I've had to sit through many horrendous moments in hospitals, sitting with somebody who's dying, where the doctors come in with a cheerful, "You're looking better," and then walk out in the corridor and say, "Won't live the night." And the person is surrounded by doctors, nurses, relatives, all of whom are so frightened of death, ministers, rabbis, so frightened of death that there is a surrounding hysterical denial of the process, leaving the person at the moment when they need most to be able to share what's happening to them, a total void of that kind of compassion. And I'm sure most of you have seen those situations, and many of us have participated in, not knowing quite what else to do. And the hospice movement has done an incredible amount to change the image of dying. They are doing for dying what home deliveries and so on, and bringing the husbands into the hospital during the deliveries, is doing for birth. It's bringing it out of the closet. Suddenly we're getting over our Victorian uptightness. It's now suddenly true that human beings do not only eat, but they go to the toilet. Bet you never knew that. And they are born and they die. In India, it's very far out because it's all right out front. When somebody dies, they wrap them in a sheet, and sometimes in a little village, they'll put them in a rickshaw to take them to the burning ghat. And there's a dead being sitting in a rickshaw on the way to the burning ghat. And everybody salutes as he goes by, or she goes by, on the way to the burning ghat. And there's God, and there's no... which we have, which is the minute the person dies, they disappear into the big void beyond. The sheet goes over, and the whole thing is covered, and denial starts immediately. So hospice is doing a great deal just by training people to be compassionate listeners and psychologically able to hang out with people who are dying without freaking. My own work is a little further out than that. My work is for people who say, I would like to use my death as a vehicle for awakening. I would actually like to use the process of dying as a vehicle for awakening, since I have an understanding of the kinds of things you've been talking about. Now, you've got to understand that that tradition of using death in that way is understood by more people in the world today than there are who don't understand that. I mean, we're talking about China, we're talking about India, we're talking about Japan, we're talking about all of the Eastern countries, which population are many. So for such a person, one sits down and one is first very straight. There's no hiding, there's no deception of anything. Your own fear, out in the open. We share it, very straight. But in addition, we are working on ourselves to create a space, an environment, in which a person can experience the deeper parts of their beings, and when they get to one level of it, where time isn't, then there's no more death. Sometimes I just go and I sit in a room with somebody that's dying and I merely sit there quietly with them. And they run all of their fear through me. And what comes back is peace. Because I don't have any fear of death that I can touch at the moment. To me, death is a process of just leaving what you thought you were. Not what you are, but what you thought you were. They run their fear through, and what comes back is peace, and they release a little bit. And then they run more fear through, and they get back peace. And they run more fear through, and they get back peace. Until you can just feel them. They're just like a flower, opening and extending and opening out. Until again and again you're sitting with somebody who is in incredible pain and suffering, and they're saying, oh, it's so beautiful. I'm feeling such peace. And at the same moment, the ravages of cancer or extreme heart conditions or whatever, Hodgkin's disease. I was working with a boy who just died 2 weeks ago. And I would come in each time, and he would be agitated and irritated, and he had bed sores, and there was a lot of pain and suffering. And I'd wash him and help change him and just be with him. But at the same moment, I was just being quiet inside my own being. In other words, I wasn't coming on to him. I wasn't saying, you ought to go deeper in yourself. I wasn't hustling him. I was merely working on myself in his presence. And the result of that was that very slowly he started to let go of identifying with the body, identifying with the pain, the psychological part, and started to experience just a spaciousness.